When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Welcome back, listeners, to Seaweed Brain, a Percy Jackson podcast where we are slowly coming to the end of our post-season one era. Today, we have a special guest. Today, we are doing an episode with someone who knows nothing of Percy Jackson besides having watched the TV show. So we can finally answer that question. Stick around. Hi, everyone. I'm Erica, joined as always by my co-host, Carter.
Hi.
And today we have an extra special guest. Say hello, Sam.
Hello. Some might say Sam is the newest Olympian, because as Erica said, Sam's special expertise that they're bringing to today's episode is the fact that they have no prior knowledge or exposure to the relevant content. I think this is going to be the time where we will drop in, for journalistic integrity purposes, a pre-interview that was taped with Sam before Sam watched any of the episodes of the TV show. This is to set a baseline to answer relevant questions about what spoilers Sam may or may not have had exposure to. And I think that for most of the main ones, we're in the clear, other than some obvious facts like Percy and Annabeth survived to age 16, among other things.
We're going to be doing a pre-interview now. Sam is going to be our designated not book reader to benchmark the series with. Do you want to say hi, Sam?
Hello.
Yeah, I think is both an ideal and non-ideal non-reader benchmark, because Sam knows some things about Percy Jackson and the extended series universe at this point, which I think honestly is useful because most people clicking into this are familiar with it as a concept, something that exists in the world that seeps in. You have ideas. Probably most people know it's about Greek mythology. So at this point, we're going to, before Sam has seen any of the episodes, and since Sam has not read the books, we're going to check in to see what Sam knows about Percy Jackson.
I know that Percy is the son of Poseidon. He's the son of Sally, who is apparently mother. I know that he is friends with this 24-year-old man called Grover, who is apparently like a satyr type animal person. He eventually gets with Annabeth, who is the daughter of Athena, and they are the greatest love story of all time, and it is pronounced Persebeth.
Yes.
I don't know much about the Lightning Thief. I don't know who the Lightning Thief is. I don't know why he is trying to find the Lightning Thief. I'm not sure if it's because he's trying to clear his name because people are trying to blame him, or if he's just going on a quest because that's apparently what demigods do. But I'm excited to see what happens with this lightning thief fiasco. And I know there's a recurring motif of exploding toilets, and he has control over water, and he's in New York City.
Real quick, what prior exposure do you have to anything related to Percy Jackson? We've established that they haven't read the books. Have you seen any of the movies? Have you, say, heard any insightful podcasters say anything about the extended Rick Riordan universe?
I have listened to the Seaweed Brain podcast, and that gave me a lot of information in terms of like the most recent book.
The most recent book being Chalice of the Gods, right?
Yeah, and I really enjoyed the extended discourse on Twinkery. Other than that, I think I've only seen one scene from the original like movie, that which I understand is not great. The only scene I saw was Uma Thurman serving as Medusa. And then, you know, eventually she got killed, but I don't remember how that happened.
Okay, great.
Carter, was among those early pre-interview questions anything about other childhood media that sort of took the place of Percy Jackson?
I don't believe we talked about that. We didn't talk about that. And we didn't talk about like baseline ideas, haterisms, etc. Mm-hmm. Do you want to share what your formative childhood media experiences were?
Yeah. Will you say something you really loved as a kid and something you absolutely despised?
First of all, thank you for the wonderful introduction. I'm so proud to represent my demographic of illiterate geriatrics. but I guess growing up in classic nerdy like Asian American experience, I think a lot of the media, fantasy media consumed was like anime and the like.
The like being Avatar The Last Airbender
yeah.
in this context.
Yeah, adjacency.
Sam, did you see that Albert Kim, the showrunner of Netflix's Avatar The Last Airbender, will not be showrunning for seasons 2 and 3 of that show, but will be remaining as an executive producer, as well as joining season 2 of Percy Jackson as an executive producer?
Ooh.
This news dropped yesterday.
Wow.
From the time that we're recording.
Like, what does that mean in the context of Percy Jackson, even that they already have showrunners? That's fascinating.
Executive producing means a lot of different things when it comes to TV. Yeah, it could mean executive producing with a lens on directing. It could mean executive producing with a lens towards writing. My understanding is that Albert's role is predominantly in the like overseeing the story sense. Not that he is necessarily like going to be listed in like the writer's room for any of these episodes, but sort of like just like a creative eye on everything.
Fascinating. Fascinating.
Sorry, continue. That was a little Avatar Percy interjection.
For listeners who want to hear more of our thoughts about that, we did record a Patreon episode about this. That you can find on our Patreon.
Patreon.com/seaweedbrain.
I guess in terms of Western media that I watched, my older sister had like the DVD box set of The Lord of the Rings extended edition. So I've watched that back and forth like at least like 10 times growing up with like the director commentary, extended cut, everything. Mm-hmm. So, you know, I kind of immerse myself in that type of fantasy world.
Right. Not that that's geriatric, but it's not geriatric.
To say it's dating me. All the time, yeah.
Well, it's dating my sister. I was like 8, 6. I don't know. I was like around or
you
under
were not selecting
age 10.
The media.
Yeah. No, I was.
And simply... you were getting an older generation of media.
Exactly. Yeah.
What was your favorite of the movies as a kid? Because I had a strong favorite movie as an 8-year-old watching The Lord of the Rings.
I like The Return of the King because I like.
Were you Two Towers?
Yeah. I really like the big orc fight. I just thought that was the best thing ever.
Okay. I think another important piece of context here that you should describe is your TV consumption habits.
When I don't like something, I physically cannot get through watching it. I am sighing, rolling my eyes.
Little baby barf in the mouth.
Even if it's just by myself, I am letting the whole world know that I am not enjoying myself in this moment and that this is like the writing is predictable. It's trite. The acting is bad. It's stiff. I am an absolute hater when it comes to like poorly executed media.
Love that.
Sam has not sat through, say, one of the other CW shows from the mid-2010s. Like there was an occasion once where Sam and I recently were watching a Netflix show with some people who I very much deeply respect and are icons in it and other people who are not. And Sam like physically could not get through it. Like loud groaning, sighing.
Perhaps it's also a reflection of like good media literacy. I know exactly where things are going, but that to me makes things boring.
Absolutely.
You know?
Carter and I talk about that all the time. Like the shows that we really enjoy, I feel like, are the shows that actually manage to surprise us.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
I would say that The Watchmen HBO is like the greatest example of that, where I never had any idea where that was going. And I was constantly like on the edge of my seat. Yeah.
I do feel like there are different types of haters. I think Erica and I are both very much people who are haters, but also grew up consuming a lot of TV that was sometimes of questionable quality. And we can sit through TV that is bad and find things to appreciate about it. But that is not a characteristic of Sam, who we're interviewing today.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
So Sam, you don't like Riverdale even ironically.
Oh, no, I couldn't get, it was a painful experience for me.
Anyway, that's background. I think there are two overarching questions that we should start with.
Uh-huh.
One of which is one that we were primed with in the pre-interview about the Lightning Thief. You did not know who the Lightning Thief was. Do you want to talk about your journey with that question as the show progressed and how this worked for you as a mystery or like a running theme, a running question to organize the show?
We want to know what episode you figured it out.
I clocked it?
Yeah.
Well, for context, going into this, I was like, oh, the son of Hermes, the god of thieves, you know, Luke would be the Lightning Thief. Because I'm like, it's obviously not Percy. And I'm like, I knew enough that Persephone was the greatest love story of all time. So I'm like,
I feel like
this type of betrayal is not something you get over on like, you know, year one of knowing each other.
Fair.
Other shows have done it. Other shows have tried.
So who is like remaining? Like, you know, like they were like, oh, maybe it's Ares. And I'm like, isn't the whole thing that like the gods can't like actually do anything directly? So like, you know, if it was Ares, he would have been working through a proxy. And Ares' daughter, the angry woman, she...
Not diminishing her to the angry woman.
That's kind of her characterization so far.
It is.
She's too irrelevant. Like, she's a minor antagonist. She's not, like, you know, the secret mastermind behind all this. Also, like, having been literate about Greek and Roman mythology in general, I'm like, Ares is not a smart person. It's not tactical war. Tactical war is Athena. And so, you know, I don't think his children are necessarily like masterminding like this whole lightning thief extravaganza in the background.
Extravaganza.
So, but for you, a lot of these reasons then are reasons that are sort of structural to the way that television is made and stories are told, as opposed to like you clocking individual actions from the characters or ways that scenes were shot or something that would lead you to believe that somebody is particularly suspicious.
Yeah. I mean, I'm looking through my notes and I took notes on several different things, but like on episode 7, I was like, oh, the feint that they threw at me to try and get me to believe that Annabeth portrayed Percy and was the actual lightning thief. And I was like, my media literacy. No, that's not the case.
That was the thing I was going to ask you about. Yeah. Because I think mostly because of the conversations with our patrons, people were telling us that this is something that we should be paying attention to. And we had to try to keep reminding ourselves. And I don't think that we were ever able to really meaningfully assess this as a potential thing that they were trying to set up in the writer's room. Like, but it sounds like you also were not feeling that as...
No, I mean, I was like, oh, it seems like they're trying to sell this to me, because the whole like you'll be betrayed by a friend, and then like everyone's like I don't trust you, and then like in episode 7, sorry, my notes are a little bit scattered, so the first thing I wrote for episode 7 was asphodel bald-headed queens. I don't know what that means.
We're already pretty far into the episode that there were bald-headed queens in asphodel in the episode. So but it sounds like then that the moment that you're picking up on is where Annabeth gets trapped in Asphodel and then has to escape early.
Yeah, I wrote
a
good reason for Annabeth to sit this one out, and it's because of regret.
Yeah.
That's what I wrote.
Regret is always a good reason to sit something out.
Yeah.
So you clocked that, and you were like, this is maybe an instance where the writers are trying to tell us that Annabeth could still be a suspect, but you also were not following them along on that journey.
You know, I saw the breadcrumbs. I saw the trail they were leading. I just was like, I'm not following those. That's not...
But, okay, when you say that you weren't following that, do you feel like that is more because of like a particular set of moments or characterizations of Annabeth? Or was that more like you were really dropped into the Luke theory? Or was it like plot reasons? Like, it's not going to work if Annabeth, the second most important character in the show, is the betrayer.
It's plot and also character. The deceptiveness would not match. And it seemed like The seeds of Percibeth, the greatest love story of all time, was already planted pretty early in the show. And so, you know, it didn't make sense for her to be the betrayer. Also, if you take a step back and you're like, what are the motivations for people to do X, Y, and Z? Mm-hmm. They cast Annabeth as the potential lightning thief through circumstance and like suspicion of character. But if you like think about it objectively, like motivation wise, she doesn't really have the motivation. Like, why would she be the lightning thief? What does she gain from this?
Right, because she is set up from the jump as somebody who respects her mother. Like, that is her whole gag. Unless she was doing a full lie, like a true like Professor Quirrell thing, then that would be surprising.
The only motivation I can think of is like, oh, she just really wanted to go on a quest, so she needed to like kickstart the whole quest. You know, but Annabeth being two steps ahead, that's like 17 steps ahead, sweetie.
I think that would also be bad writing because, I mean, not to harp on this Quirrell example, it's not a good twist if you just say that everything you knew about the character is a lie. That's lazy.
That person's not a good writer. And that's why their book flopped when they didn't have their name attached to it.
Okay, so that's the main thing we wanted to ask about. The other thing, obviously, that our podcast needs to get into is the Percibeth of it all. Mm-hmm. How did this work for you? How did you feel you went down this journey?
I didn't know what the trajectory of Percibeth was going to be. And so coming into this, I was like, the trope that they have settled into is like rivals to friends to lovers. And, you know, I enjoy that. I don't particularly like enemies to lovers. It's too much. It's too much conflict for me. My constitution cannot survive so much emotional turmoil.
I'm a little bit too millennial.
Yeah, yeah.
Maybe back in 2015.
No. I say I can't do it. Wait. Oh, you're saying I'm too old.
Yeah, okay, that's what I'm saying.
I think, you know, I usually do not like child actors. I think they actually did a pretty good job. Like,
did a pretty good job.
Yeah, no, because as we established earlier, I cannot, like, cringy acting just gets me out the door. But I think the way that Annabeth looks at Percy differently after like they defeat Medusa together was like kind of a moment.
Are you thinking specifically of that shot where she is standing inside of the house looking at him holding up the Medusa's head?
Yeah, she looked at him and was like, all right, I see you. Like, it's like, I see you, right? Like, it's no longer you're just there. It's like, I see you as a person, as an individual.
Yeah. You're not just my pawn in my plan. Yeah. You're an individual, yeah.
And then, like, you know, when the mommy trauma happened at St. Louis, you know, I think her genuine care for him started popping out a little bit.
Did the title of love work for you?
I felt that was a little heavy-handed. I was like, okay. I was like, oh, they're going to go down a tunnel of love, aren't they? And then they do. And I'm like, all right, okay, we get it. It's okay to have some tropes. It's fine. And I enjoyed that they did it in a slightly different way. The atmosphere was not like, you know, sunshine and rainbows. It was like, ooh, creepy, eerie. And, you know, if you think about the overall trajectory of like, this is not necessarily a lighthearted story, but it's also not like super dark, but there are like moments of like, you know, peril and like danger and, you know, some heavier themes. So like, I think their love tunnel being one that's cast in shadow does help foreshadow a little bit of like, you know, their overall emotional journey.
Ooh. This is interesting. So if the tunnel of love was a lighter hearted affair, more of comedic relief and or sort of like an amuse-bouche for the idea of
an awkward
romantic
handhold.
Compatibility, an awkward handhold between these characters, you would have been more disinvested.
Yeah.
You think that it needed the like anchoring, the weight.
Yeah. It needed to be different. Like if it was truly just like straight out of like the random like trope book of like, you know, love stories, I would like hate it.
You're not there for people being trapped in an elevator together.
Oh my god, there's the sigh! There's the sigh they warned us about!
Yeah, no, I'm... Even took a note on this in episode 4. Greatest love story of all time in the love tunnel, of course. And I also wrote that Hephaestus's palace would be a great ride at Disney World, lol.
That, the people have been saying. Hey, yeah. Love tunnel, IRL, when?
I'm very curious. Obviously, we're, like, sold the idea of these three kids becoming, like, best friends, you know, like they have to have the chemistry that's like believable and they have to trauma bond to a level that is believable. Not being someone who grew up being like hammered over the head about like Percy Annabeth Grover, were you like, oh yeah, this is a believable like little trio, like I feel for them together?
So Grover took some time to grow on me. First I was like, why is this 24-year-old man like hanging out with like 13-year-old children? Like I don't understand. Like it's like, yes, you look like you're 13, but like if you're mentally 24, why are you doing this? Like, how are you able to, like, relate to them on, like, such a, like, direct level? It felt like he really was actually just 13, but they just had to add in the detail of he's actually 24 to make it, like, a little bit more fun.
So, okay, this is really interesting. This is something that I've been thinking about on and off, but this is a useful perspective. In the book, there is very crucially a line immediately after they share Grover's age about how satyrs mature at half the rate of humans. So developmentally, you might compare him to a 12-year-old, but he has literally more experiences. And I think in the book, it's meant to hammer home the idea that he's, like, a late bloomer.
Yeah.
But I see. So this genuinely was puzzling to you. You were like, this person should be post-collegiate.
Like I think that the most common form of this trope that I've seen is like, you know, someone who looks very young, but is actually has years of wisdom beyond like their physical appearance.
Right.
And Grover is instead, I am for all intents and purposes, actually like 12, but I am actually 24.
Right.
And that detail does make sense because if it's like the maturing is also at half the rate, then maybe.
Yeah.
But I'm like, you know, he's already been through an entire traumatic adventure with the previous forbidden child dying. Mm-hmm. And like his level of maturity is still like not proportional to his experience, I don't think.
Right. Okay, so you think if we got that extra line, like Carter mentioned, it would have clarified.
Yeah, yeah. You know, this is world building, right? I needed yes, magical world. Some people are older than they appear. Like, the gods are ancient. But, like, this particular one where it's so crucial to, like, the three and, like, their dynamic, I felt like it was really important to clarify, like, why this 24-year-old is acting like a 12-year-old.
Yeah.
So you did not find him to be especially emotionally intelligent, or you were not... You didn't feel that there were any things about the characterization that suggested additional age relative to Annabeth and Percy.
I think the only thing that really showed Grover having emotional maturity is the way that he helps de-escalate and like take care of high stress situations. It's giving camp counselor in the way that he just like singing a song, but like that is reflective of having a little bit more experience of being like, oh no, like it's important that we work together and that these conflicts don't actually matter that much. We just all need to just take a breath, and sometimes singing is the way to do it.
Sam is also somebody with managerial experiences.
It's my job to give feedback to people.
How did you feel about the different feedback methods?
I would never sing to my direct reports. No, Grover is not me. And so Grover is not giving feedback the way that I would.
Your direct feedback. Reports are also old.
Yeah, they're also all older than me. Can you believe that?
Yeah.
You know, I think real feedback should be like direct, specific, and provide opportunity for growth. So it's like forward looking. When you like blame each other, like it disrupts, you know, our team dynamic, and that prevents us from working better in the future. Right? Like it's like it clearly lays out the consequences of their actions and then helps provide a motivation for them internally as to why they want to do better. Because it's like ultimately, it's not about whether or not I get along with you. It's like, you know, we both want to succeed in this quest. And so our not getting along is getting in the way of that. So we're only harming ourselves, right?
So room for improvement in Grover's communication.
No, like I would check meets expectations, but not exceeds expectations for his like communication skills.
Sam is a Cloven Elder, clearly. Wait, I have a question. Okay, so regarding the Grover, like we needed that extra sentence about Satyr's maturing half as fast. There's been an ongoing conversation about the amount of lore dropping, basically, and like explaining the mechanics of how the world works and whether there should have been more or should have been less. And I'm curious what you thought about that.
I actually thought the world was perfectly amount of lore. Questions I had were, you know, in the first episode, I was like, no one else sees this. Okay, that's fine.
Right.
Like, I understood that they already established through a couple, like, flashbacks that, like, you know, he sees things that other people don't see. And so, like, that also happens. I think the thing that was a little bit more confusing, but they did explain, was, like, that teacher should have just, like, disappeared from, like, everyone's collective consciousness. That, I thought, was a little bit, like, expansive powers of, like, rewriting reality and people's perception. But I was like, you know, I'll accept it. They kind of explained it a couple episodes later.
But you never felt, like, hit over the head with, like, this is how the world works or anything like that?
No, not really. I think everything made sense.
Okay.
Yeah. I didn't question the world that much. I think whenever you do fantasy, you just kind of have to suspend your disbelief to a certain extent.
Buckle up.
Well, not everyone believes in that philosophy. You know, there's the, how would you say, the Tolkiens and the George Lucases of the world who believe very much in hard world building.
No, Tolkien is famous for soft world building.
He made the language.
Oh, okay. Hard world building, but like his magic, the fantasy of it is soft.
Soft magic system.
He never explains how magic works.
Hard elven language.
Yeah. Or like, you know, how like,
we need rules for linguistics.
Language is important. Period. But, you know, magic can be soft. But also to align with like the source material of like the Greco-Roman mythological canon, like they do have like rules for the gods, which they do explain. And I appreciate that. And again, when they do that, I also just accept that. Yeah, they just have these rules. Like, I think a more critical person would be like, but why are there these rules on the gods anyways? Like, aren't they the gods? Like, why can't they intervene? Why can't they do this? Like, what happened?
Mm-hmm. But I think those are also questions that you are supposed to have, because it is deliberately ambiguous whether those are metaphysical properties or they are laws.
I'm actually not sure how they're implemented, like which of those two this world is.
Yeah.
And that's okay.
Yeah.
I'm excited for the journey.
I wanted to ask about the humor. Bearing in mind, of course, that like you are probably the most off target on background information and age person for the jokes that are written into the show.
That's so true.
How did you feel about it in terms of like volume and pitch and tone?
I don't think I ever thought this was a particularly funny show. I don't think most of the funny moments made me laugh.
Right.
I think Grover did some things that were like cute, but I wasn't like, ha ha ha. And I think,
right,
you know, there was some like physical comedy that I was like, okay.
I think that there are certain characters that tell jokes, and whether or not the jokes land on you as things that are supposed to be funny, the jokes do characterization work. Do you think that that worked for you?
The joke as a characterization, I think the scene with Ares and Grover really does that. because their entire interaction is kind of comedic. It plays off of expectations and subverting them. So you think Aries is this big, tough guy, but then he's like, did you ever watch Glass Onion? It's like, yes. Dave Bautista's character, where he's like a big man, but then his like mom comes in and like whips him into shape. Like, it's like that. It's like Aries is the big, tough man, but like he just wants someone to like listen to him. And Grover is that person.
Okay, right. So like
Percy, that was humorous, I thought.
Percy is supposed to be a character who tells jokes. Like, he's kind of quippy.
I was wondering
like if that was a characterization that landed with you, regardless of whether or not you found the quips funny.
I did take a note in episode one that the narrative intro feels authentic to Rick's sarcastic humor and writing. Because even though I didn't read the books, I did listen to your podcast about the newest book about him trying to apply to college. And, you know, you two dissected the way that like Rick's voice is kind of Percy's voice. And so I got bits and pieces of that.
So if we were to say for a moment that like one of the projects of the show is for it to be like genuinely like out loud haha funny for people of all ages, and we were writing the show, like, do you have a piece of like children's media that you will rewatch even today and like actually like laugh out loud at it?
Oh, you forgot the OG.
I think
when you were lining up your influences.
SpongeBob?
Yes! I would say SpongeBob and Phineas and Ferb for sure. Yeah. No matter my age, I will always haha out loud funny.
I think SpongeBob is genuinely hilarious. I love
it. But there are like different approaches to that idea of like across ages funny. Like SpongeBob is like mostly absurdism, right? Whereas like I'm not really a chronic SpongeBob viewer. This is just my impression.
I don't think SpongeBob is absurdist. He has like a normal job, and like much of the humor comes from Squidward just being like frustrated with SpongeBob, his coworker.
Yeah, you know. I think voice acting plus animation, right? Animation really like puts you into the scene. It's very immersive.
Yeah,
and then with voice acting,
like, campy. And there are things that you can do with overbroadness that like exactly. You can't do with kid actors.
Like the level of expression that you're able to communicate with animation is like so much greater. And so I think that really helps with helping jokes land. And then, you know, these more professional older voice actors did a really good job of just like selling the joke. I don't know. I find SpongeBob funny. I think Avatar: The Last Airbender is pretty funny.
Yeah, I've been rewatching it from the beginning slowly, and I've been laughing out loud at several moments.
You know, I think the cabbages gag is pretty funny.
Yeah, ongoing yeah. gags. Mm-hmm.
There were definitely some shows that we would watch on TV when we were younger that my father would like genuinely enjoy, but like none of them came close to Phineas and Ferb, which is genuinely one of his favorite pieces of television media.
Yeah. I think the classic example that like people reference when they talk about children's media also appealing to the adults that watch it with them is like Sesame Street, where they have jokes and layers. Universal jokes that land with everyone is really hard. And so what you need to do instead is provide a variety of jokes that hit high and low. And then like some people will get it and some people won't. And that's okay because they have other jokes that they will get. You know,
right.
That also helps make it feel more like, oh, they're making it for me. But then like the magic of it is that everyone gets to feel like, oh, they're making it for me, because like that joke really hit with me. And the jokes they miss, they don't even realize really that they're missing.
Right. That's a great point.
There's like a genuine schism, I think, in schools of thought between that idea where you can definitely clock specific jokes that are not meant for children to understand. Shrek comes to mind. Mm-hmm. I think Phineas and Ferb has like not even like adult jokes, but like a lot of references to like media from the 1930s through the 1980s that like clearly children would not be able to understand. I think the other approach is to do like sight gags, physical comedy, like comedies of errors, like the idea of doing like a who's on first type of miscommunication gag, I think in theory is supposed to be something that should appeal to people of all ages and backgrounds. But
you play the game, you hit a running gag, you hit a running bit, or you hit like a mini game in a scene. That's like the improv way of describing it, is like you find something that's unusual and then you repeat it until it's not funny anymore. Mm-hmm. Whether that's in like the scope of like a 4-minute piece of dialogue, like a who's on first thing, or whether that's long running cabbages bit that you do the entire series.
The SpongeBob bit that still gets me, that really exemplifies, is this like wumbo.
I wumbo, you wumbo.
I, he, she, they wumbo.
Wombology, the study of wumbo.
I love that. It's so good.
Yeah, but I think that's a great observation that we can hear from Sam. It didn't feel as though the mission of the show was to be comedic. Mm-hmm. And I think we very much felt that way too.
Yeah.
But we'll see about season two, if season two shifts that tone a little bit.
I guess in terms of characterization for Percy, it was effective in like making him like kind of a sassy like 12-year-old.
Yeah.
Okay.
And like, oh, Annabeth more so. Like, she's also like a sassy 12-year-old.
I think that's a useful note. Okay, yeah. That even when you weren't laughing, you like
understood. I understood what it was, yeah. Like that they have personalities and they're like sarcastic and just yeah. Wasn't my ha ha ha, but you know, mm-hmm. It's fine.
And even though it was more, this is a very black and white binary, but perhaps it was a little more dramatic than comedic, it was still engaging to you.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's correct.
Okay. Should we ask about the Luke turn? Now
my notes are, I was like, oh, Luke is a thief because he's the son of Hermes, the god of thieves, but also he has daddy issues, and so that's like that's what takes him beyond, you know, I'm just the son of Hermes to like I have a personal vendetta against the gods.
Setting aside dramatic tension related to expectations or surprise, how did you feel about the execution of the scene, thinking about its implications for future seasons of the show potentially?
I was
the
like,
way it looked,
you know,
the drama of it.
I knew that there was, you know, I semi-expect a redemption arc for Luke, because the note I took was that he's not evil. He's just a misguided, angsty teen who has, mm-hmm. you know, daddy issues, and mm-hmm, that's, mm-hmm, like, mm-hmm. normal and fine. Mm-hmm. It's just that, like, the consequences of his actions are, like, a bit higher. But the stakes of everything is higher here, so mm-hmm, that's mm-hmm. just kind of right. within the world.
Yeah.
He still has a tenderness in him for Percy, and I think he still sympathizes with Percy for also being abandoned by his dad. And so mm-hmm. I think overall, it sets him up to be, like, a complex, sympathetic villain, or, like, a minor antagonist, or whatever, what have you. And, you know, I came into this knowing that there's at least 5 books in this original series. Mm-hmm. They're setting up more to come, right? And, like, you know, I have questions. Like, did Kronos enter, like, Luke's dream? Like, it was unclear, like, whose dreams Kronos was entering. I was like, okay, like, there's definitely machinations by Kronos, but it's unclear, like, how direct it was. Because in the ending scene, it seemed like the way Luke presented it was like, this is my idea because of, like, you know, my dad and all that. And, you know, I think as a 12-year-old, like, that's been slighted by his dad, or he's like a bit older, maybe 14-year-old, that's been slighted by his, like, dad, I think there's a tendency to think that everything was, like, your idea. So maybe that's also, like, unreliable narrator of, like, you know, maybe Kronos did come to him and he's just like, oh, but that's my dream. And he doesn't even realize he's being manipulated because, you know, mm-hmm. that's what good manipulators do. Mm-hmm. I also clocked that they had an Olivia Rodrigo song in the background on episode 1. It's one of the background music.
And how did you feel about that? Did it pull you out of the scene? Did it, like, add to the scene? Did it add to Sally?
The only thing it did was, like, remind me that I am a bit too old to be watching this.
Okay. Speaking of too old to be watching this, how did you feel about the Dula needle drop in episode 6 when they're about to go to the casino?
Dula peep. I thought it was fine. I just was, you had talked to me in advance about that.
That's my bad.
And you framed it in a way that was like, this was going to be, you know, not great. But if I went to, like, a casino, that is appropriately dated for the type of music they would play.
I feel like that was the conversation we had on our episode 2, right?
It's actually,
like, this
immersive.
Is the kind of song that we'll be playing in a department store.
Exactly. Yeah.
Yeah.
That's actually what, like, the millennial in charge of, like, the music blasting through, like, the bad, like, speakers of, like, a corporate, like, entity would play.
Yeah.
What did you think about Camp Half-Blood visually? Did it draw you in? Did it make you want, like, Camp Half-Blood Disney World, or do you want more from it? Did you wish that we were there longer?
I never went to camp as, like, a child. I think the appeal of camp in media often draws upon, like, nostalgic personal experience to be like, oh, I also went camping. I love camping. I love being in the woods. I love being in the woods. I just, you know, I have a routine for my hair. Like, I can't. I need running water. So, like, Camp Half-Blood is not, I need to glamp, and that was not glamp.
Sam would get along really well with my mom. I'm really looking forward to you meeting my mom, Sam.
I'm looking forward to that too, mother.
Okay, but did you feel like we were there long enough? Because, you know, it's really quick in and out.
Yeah, it was really quick in and out, and then we returned at the end, and I'm like, oh, you know, they had to make use of that set. But
so real. It's still standing as far as we know, somewhere in the woods of British Columbia.
The environment of it was not super interesting to me. I was more interested in like the story and like the adventure that they were going to go on. And I'm like, this is a fine like home base before you like go on in your next mission, you know?
Yeah.
And
it sounds like what you're saying is it was like serviceable, correct, but like kind of generic and did not.
It's like a hub world basically, right? Where you just return to it at the beginning and end of everything. And I'm like, it's a cute hub world.
Did you think that Chiron and Mr. D were also gay?
I wrote that I appreciate that all the gods are kind of bisexual coded. Like everyone's a little bit gay. And I think that's correct. That's accurate. I think that's respectful of the canon. Everyone's just a little bit gay.
Respectful of the canon. Yeah.
Respectful of the canon of historical events.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Was it ever too dark for you?
No.
Really?
Meant, like, literally light design. Dark.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, the screen?
Yeah.
Sam has a TV, so.
I have a TV.
Different.
So you could see it on the TV.
I actually never noticed. Like, you know, there are other shows like Game of Thrones where, like, it's dark. But this one, I it wasn't like a particular issue I had. I never was like, this is too dark.
Okay, that's good. That's good to hear.
Okay. Just to like harp a little bit more on this world building conversation. We have some ideas about like visual signifiers of the world that you've described.
Mm-hmm.
At a high level, like the idea of Percy Jackson, I would say, is like juxtaposition of like a fantastical classical world over modernity and looking at sort of the contradictions that would arise from that. Do you think that that was executed in a way that worked for you, had like a particular point of view?
I didn't think it was really saying that. I didn't feel like there were any real interactions between the real world and the magical world. I thought even what I was talking about earlier with like the way it like is like hidden by glamour, the whole point is that like there's a complete lack of awareness. Like there's almost no real interaction between the real world and the magical world, and any interaction is immediately rewritten and like retconned a little bit. And so like it's like there is almost like the magical world does not affect the real world. The real world does affect the magical world because the magical world people live in the real world. But I don't remember any influence the real world has had on the magical world that I've seen in this thing.
Yeah, we needed like, we would need those comment. There's things in the book where we hear about like how much the police are looking for Percy and how they're on the run from the cops. And we get little glimpses of that in the train when they're talking to the cops. And we get like a little glimpse of that in like a very subtle sound cue when they enter the Montauk cabin. And you can hear like the radio talking about them. But I don't think we really see that as much in the show as we see it in the book.
So if you had seen, for instance, like regular people turning on the radio and seeing huge storm warnings because of the fight between Zeus and Poseidon or something, would you have been like, okay, I can understand the way these worlds interplay?
Yeah.
Or there
are
like things like that?
The gods have power over like natural disasters, right? Mm-hmm. And so like natural disasters then being like actually experienced by the real world. That would be a good example of like there being consequences. But so far, everything has been like, even like the whole scene in the bus where Electo comes at them.
Yeah.
You felt like there were no consequences for anybody else on the bus.
Yeah, pretty much. I say that's actually kind of a plus in terms of like how they explain how this world exists alongside ours, but we just are not aware. And
Right.
But like, I think our unawareness comes at the cost of there being like minimal consequences of what's happening in this world. Right?
Right.
And then also, they're always averting disaster. And so you never get to see the cataclysm being experienced, like the fallout.
Yet. Yeah.
Yet.
Interesting. Right? Interesting.
I feel like we don't even really get that until the last Olympian, honestly.
Mortals experiencing
the cataclysm.
I don't know.
Well, I guess Rachel Elizabeth Dare.
There's Rachel Elizabeth Dare, but I also feel like generally, this is a discussion that we had about like the way that the show handles interplay between the two worlds. And I think that what I'm taking away for this conversation, like I didn't even clock some of those things as being things that were in the book that were not in the show that really informed my implicit idea about the way these worlds are interacting.
Yeah.
Because I think that like if you're trying to think about like what sets Percy Jackson apart as a piece of media, the interaction I think is very important. And a sense that like it's not necessarily that you don't feel like a clarity or a point of view in the way that the interaction is being communicated is worth noting.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
No, I feel really strongly about that. Like in these post season one weeks, like really reflecting back on the show. And also as I'm working my way through Black Sails and now having this conversation with Sam, I feel like the juxtaposition that we think is so important wasn't the primary focus in the like interpretation to the screen, that it was much more about concepts of monstrosity, building the world, setting up these characters and the relationships, and that layering of the classical on top of the modernity was not the focus.
Mm-hmm. But I think with five seasons, we can make it a focus, and it can make sense to change the way that that is handled over the course of the subsequent seasons. And
especially because from a marketing business perspective, like, we have now established the world, we've drawn in audiences, we've given them compelling characters and relationships and visuals. And now we can say, okay, it's not just another fantasy show. It is unique for this specific reason, in which we'll start to see them interacting more with the real world.
I think the only section that I really was like, oh, this is the interconnectedness of our world and the real world, was Medusa and her lair, right? It's like, I think this idea of like, you're just wandering down a path and then you stumble upon a piece of the world that's not really your world. That's a common trope, like that Spirited Away, right? Like, you just wander into another realm. Like, you're following this random path in New Jersey and you end up on Medusa's doorstep, right? I like that because it's like, previous depictions is like the world, their magical world is separated from our world. Right? Like, there's a literal wall at Camp Half-Blood, right? Magical barrier. Everywhere else, like, there's a glamour on people and like they're not perceived. But like in Medusa, it seemed like a poor hiker would get lost and stumble upon her world and be like petrified.
Yeah. I keep thinking, I love the Medusa costume, but would it have achieved this thing that Carter and I are talking about more if it was like, instead of her looking so gorgeous in that beautiful house, if she was like a waitress inside of that diner?
Yeah, that and looked more regular.
If she was more
integrated into mortal worlds.
Yeah. If she was a little more regular and they like sat down at the diner and then she like came up to take their order, and that's when they realized that she was Medusa.
Well, I guess the other side of this coin then that Medusa also brings up is that if we're not exploring inter-world dynamics that well, how did the intra-world dynamics work in terms of ideas about monsters and gods and who has power and who shouldn't have power and
here
who's righteous
notes.
And
here
who's
come
not.
The notes.
How did
Sam is ready.
Do you feel like they told a compelling story about this? What were your thoughts?
First of all, Medusa did nothing wrong. Okay. I am Team Medusa. Like, Athena is just like,
wait, did you also think Medusa was gay?
Yes. Yes, she's so bisexual coded. Medusa did nothing wrong. And then, like, Athena is just, like, an angry, like, prude. Athena is just, like, slut-shaming everyone.
Yeah.
Yeah.
She does do that.
Antiquity. Yeah. And it's, like, really annoying. And I'm like, I am sex positive. I don't subscribe to this.
So you feel like there was meaningful complication of ideas about monsters, and then on the other side, ideas about gods.
Well, first of all, one axis in which you perceive monsters and also gods is the same, and that's fear. You fear both of them. And you fear both of them because they can both be terrible, and terrible in like the broadest sense of the word, and that they can do
terrible like power.
Terrible as like incredibly powerful things that they can do, and they can also be incredibly cruel. Right? Like they're all terrible in that sense, right? And then in the way that Greek mythology starts, like they're all like kind of caricatures of like ideas and personalities and like thoughts, right? And so like in the way that, like, a monster is, like, you know, usually an allegory for something, the gods themselves are also allegories. So, like, gods and monsters are kind of the same thing. And it just happens to be, like, you know, one side gets accolades and the other side is subjugated.
Yeah.
And I'm advocating for, like, the monsters to seize the means of production.
Yes!
Like, I'm just like, you know,
Wait till House of Hades.
Yeah. And I'm like, you know, like, a lot of these monsters are themselves, like, the children or creations of the gods. And I think that maybe says something about humanity's own inherent monstrosity, because we come from similar origins as the monsters. And so we are also, like, children and creations of the gods.
Yeah.
And so I think that says something about like the inherent monstrosity that we have within us. And I think humans also, in some ways, we try to emulate the gods. So like we kind of represent the amalgam of those two ideas, and the fact that they're all inside us are two wolves. And the two wolves are gods and monsters.
One of them is gay, the other one is gay.
Yeah, and they're all gay. Well, I'm gay.
Yeah. Okay. I think that was a good reading. The follow-up question is, how much of that reading do you think is reflected in just general Greco-Roman mythologic canon? How much of it do you think comes through in the show?
In the show, the gods are definitely presented as more positive. less monstrous. I don't know. You have a sense of unease when you're meeting Hades. You have a sense of unease when there's Ares. When there's Ares, like, that is how I feel around that demographic of people in the real world. Where they're like angry and yelling at me, I am scared for my physical well-being a little bit.
No shame to Adam Copeland, who we're sure is a lovely person.
Yeah, and then like I think it makes sense that those two are kind of like the scarier world. Well, Hades less so.
We were talking on the soundtrack episode about how the scariest music that ever shows up in the show is when we're walking to go meet Zeus. How did you feel about Zeus?
Did you feel like he was our enemy from Percy's perspective?
Okay, I think thinking back, like in terms of how he was depicted in the show, I think he has like minor antagonist vibes because Poseidon had to swallow his pride and like apologize and make good with Zeus. Zeus is like the one that you need to appease. It's the one that like, you know, everyone's kind of on the watch out for. And he's like a bad manager, right? We're like, he's a tyrant. I think that's the best way to describe it. Yeah.
Does that mean we can ask our like closing questions now?
I think so, yeah.
Okay. Or is there anything else you want to get off your chest first? Anything from the notes from the vault?
I said at minute 3:31 in episode 1, I clocked the foreshadowing of Perseus holding Medusa's severed head at the Met.
Yes. Good, good.
I have a question about like why Sally is with Gabe at all. I don't see like any there's nothing in that relationship that tells me that this is rewarding for her in any way. There's like nothing there. Like that, she, like even in like the first season, she's already treating him like a child, where she's like, excuse me, like this is like my son. I'm doing what I'm doing. This is my car. I earned. Yeah. Like, I'm just like, what does he do?
I think the piece of dialogue that is supposed to get us to understand that is really fast in the bus before the Mrs. Dodds fight part 2.
It's like she wanted him to have a dad. And I'm like, and this is the choice.
I think that they explain the smell thing there, but I'm not positive.
I think they don't explain it.
You don't think that they do? Did I hallucinate that? Am I making that up?
Well, because we're also doing a slightly different smell thing, right? Where it's like different monsters smell different things, and it's your fear and your anxiety and your blah, blah, blah. I don't know.
Oh, another comment about monstrosity that I took notes on was like Echidna's being like, oh, you think that you're too good for my monster, that just because like you're a hero and these are called monsters, you can just kill them. Well, no. Like I was like, yeah, that's like,
well, yes.
it's like the, like, it's arbitrary of like who is deserves to die and not. I also clocked when they said seaweed brain the first one.
Were you like, oh my god, that's the titular role?
I didn't realize seaweed brain actually was like what she calls him.
Why did you think we called the podcast that?
Because you're from Hawaii and you know you're, it's like, I thought it was like the brain rot about thinking about, because you're
the
like
brain rot. I remember
one of your first, maybe it was like one of your first podcasts where you're like, I'm seaweed and I'm brain or something like that.
That was something we said recently.
Yeah, yeah.
Somebody asked us that in like December.
Well, now I know, but I was just like, oh, you're from like Hawaii. There's lots of seaweed, and you have brain rot about Percy Jackson, or that's all you think about.
Well, it works on multiple levels.
Yeah, it does. It does. It works on multiple levels, which I enjoyed it. Yeah. Asphodel, bald-headed queens, that was good. Hades abducting woman seems to be a trend. I was like, the musical chairs of having to find the right godly weapons.
It does say Electo serves. I think that's the last Electo thing I want to pull out of these notes.
Yeah, Electo serves.
Good. Finally, someone says it who isn't just us. Thank God.
No, Electo serves. Her hair always perfectly coiffed.
Yeah, that wig was impressive.
And Sam didn't even watch Will and Grace. That's just genuine one performance based appreciation.
Wait, she's
Sam from
Will
and Grace? Dixon musical.
Wait, what about
well,
Parks
though.
And Rec?
Wait, she's the mom.
She's the mom in Dixon musical.
Oh my god, that's so funny.
Okay. I think that's a good place to bring us to our closing two questions. One of the showrunners, Jonathan E. Steinberg, said that there was a 4-part mission for the show. They were trying to make a show that appealed to people who read the books, people who had not read the books, people who were grown, and people who were young. We've had a lot of conversations about these. We, you know, like most of our guests have been from the same quadrant that we come from, which is people who are kind of old and have read the books.
Yeah.
How do you feel he did on this as somebody who is from a different quadrant?
Well, even though I haven't read the books, I did like take a lot of classics classes in college. And, you know, I have always been a fan of Greco-Roman mythology. I think a lot of queer people are, because that's often the first exposure to queerness in a school setting, because like all the gods had like a paramour that was like of the same gender mainly, basically, right? And so I had an innate interest in that. And so coming into this, I knew the context. I was like, oh, Hermes is the god. Like, I don't think they ever said Hermes is the god of thieves, right? In the series.
I think some exercises are left to the reader.
Yeah. And so like the fact that I've done some of my homework, right, means that like I probably had an easier job following along. I think they did a good job overall, because I think one of the fears as someone who is kind of old and hasn't read the books is that it's not going to hit nostalgic value for me. And so it kind of needs to be able to stand on its own. And to that extent, I think they did do a good job. I think the casting was good. I think the acting was good. I think the writing was actually pretty good. Yeah, I think everything was like, it was like well executed. And, you know, I was a little worried that it would be a bit too cheesy, cringy for me, but it wasn't. It was good. I enjoyed it. And Alecto served. And Medusa yes. served. Again, the femme monsters are mother. Echidna, yeah, herself. Echidna. Mother. Yeah.
Okay. I don't think we can ask this question in its original form, because you've only seen season one of the show. But do you think that Persepeth has laid the groundwork to potentially become the greatest love story ever told?
I mean, you know, when you go through a love tunnel together like that on a life-threatening journey, it kind of bonds you for life. So I do think they're definitely setting that up. Like, you know, I think the actress for Annabeth did a really good job of like showing her like disdain for him in the beginning, like annoyance, frustration, like this stupid boy. And she starts seeing him as like, oh, she starts seeing him. And I think that is really powerful. And I think that really sets up their potential future romantic trajectory, I suppose. Percy's side of things, I don't know. I think he's more of just like classic oblivious stupid boy at that age. You know, 12-year-old boys are dumb.
You didn't feel like he was making eyes in like, say, episode 8.
I may just be bad at clocking how straight boys see girls.
Fair.
Just like not something I, but okay, yeah, exactly. The way people who are attracted to like men longingly look at men, that I can clock from a mile away. But the way men look at women, whatever, that goes over my head.
I see. Okay. Well,
we've had many guests say similar strains of this. Like, yeah, it's cute, but it is, you know, just a boy and a girl. Like, what is special about it?
We'll see.
Oh yeah,
and, I
need to say, there's nothing. There has been no exceptionalism to Percival so far. There's nothing that's like, oh, this is the greatest. This is a love story. I just don't know if it's the greatest.
Yet. Yeah, it's not yet.
Yeah.
Okay, that means. Okay, I'm really excited to hear answer to this question now. Obviously, you're not fully like, you take into this world like what you know about classics and mythology and antiquity, and like let that come into your answer for this. Do you feel like, after the end of episode 8, you are down to join Luke and go through that portal and burn down the system of the gods?
Yeah, I mean, as I said earlier, we need to team up with the monsters and overthrow the gods. And I think that's kind of the theme of, like, I did go to a school that was well known for, you know, radical thinking.
Where did you go to undergrad?
I went to Berkeley.
Oh, okay.
So the idea of, like, wanting to overthrow the powers that be because they are abusive and not good and not good leaders is something that, like, I'm like, yes, I am team overthrow these Nepo babies. I think a younger, more naive version of me would have been like, no, why would you overthrow them? They're like the gods. No, this, like, Luke is on the side of evil. But I think now is like, you know, the gods only got to be the gods and be in power through violence. And so, like, there's a part of me that's like, oh, violence is bad. But I'm like, they only got there through violence. And so the only way to get rid of them is also probably through violence, because they're not going to willingly give up their power. And they did it through violence themselves. So, like, they obviously are not afraid to then use it to defend themselves. And
yeah,
I don't advocate for violence in the world, obviously. But, like, in terms of, like, this revolutionary, like, overthrow type of framework, violence is perhaps necessary.
Let us not ignore also the quiet violence of status quos.
Yeah.
Appears to be the natural order of
yeah exactly things. Like monsters yeah. are constantly getting like killed like just because of who they are and how they exist.
Yeah, it's like neither the true answer that I feel like we're getting at here is neither the gods nor Luke Kronos, but a secret third thing, which is the Democracy. Female monsters rise up.
Yeah, the female monsters rise up, mother.
I was thinking like we continue the like oligarchical hierarchy, but instead of Zeus it's like Echidna.
Yeah. Yeah.
And like, you know, if you think about like Medusa's interactions with the children, she's not like she tries to offer things, a negotiation as equals first of like, I help you, you help me. But, you know, and then they got refused and then she reacted badly, which is not good. But, you know, I think women would be better leaders, period.
That seems like a good place to close.
Yeah. Yay. Thanks for letting us grill you, Sam.
No, I love talking. This is so fun. I have so many thoughts and opinions.
Yay. It's always fun when we have like a brand new podcast guest too. Yeah. You know, spice things up.
I'm glad to enter the pantheon of Seaweed Brain podcast guests alongside Maddie, who won trivia.
Yes, alongside Maddie, who won trivia, and her dad, Tom. Would you say you're interested in reading the Kane Chronicles?
The Kane Chronicles?
Kane Chronicles.
What's the Kane Chronicles?
It's a trio of books that Rick Riordan wrote in 2010 through 2012 about children entering the world of legacy Egyptian sorcery to prevent the end of the world when the chaos serpent eats Ra.
Okay.
Sam,
yeah.
Do you want to plug anything before you exit?
Please keep supporting this podcast because this podcast is...
You want to plug our Patreon?
Yeah. Please join their Patreon. Please support Carter and Erica in their respective journeys in and out of this podcast. And there are exciting opportunities where you can do so via Patreon and also perhaps other things in the future.
Yeah, we can be followed on social media as well. It's true.
All right. Well, I have no idea when this episode is going to come out, but...
We have good content in the future. We're doing a lot of interviews. We are reading again. So whatever comes after this, it will be enjoyable. To you, yay! Listener. So stick around and we'll see you next time.
See ya. Bye.
Outro music.